Good evening, genties and ladlemen of the audio radiance, and welcome to Spider on the Web 24. As always, this episode is being podcast under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. I'd really like to open this week with a live interview with my wife, the successful zero-gravity choreographer, who has just come back from a trip to heaven at the end of the year 7. Sadly, she has begged off. She's still in the middle of doing interviews for national media, dance, news media, dance media, science fiction media, and she's really beginning to get tired of hearing herself answering the same questions over and over again. A lot of the information that you want to hear can probably be found at her blog, but I'm going to open right now with a little bit of time travel. I'm going to take you back to the late 80s when Jeannie and I are sitting in a dive in Vancouver called the Commodore, waiting to hear some blues, and we're having one of the very few disagreements that we ever had in the course of our collaboration on 3 novels. I've been taught by the great Alfred Bester, you should always open the book with an explosion and then build to a climax. Start with some action, throw them right in the middle of the story, and then we'll get around to telling you who's the story's happening to. Jeannie, on the other hand, says, why the hell should they care if they don't know who she is? We got to tell the audience about these people, and she's arguing her point, and I'm arguing my point. And then in the background comes on a gentleman from Beaumont, Texas, named John Winter. And as Johnny Winter, one of the greatest bluesmen who ever strung a guitar, starts to blow, Jeannie turns to me and says, give me pen and paper, give me pen and paper. And she begins to wail a little herself. By the time Mr. Winter was done explaining to us where it was at and reminding us why we ought to put up with it, Jeannie had completed my favorite part of our second novel, Starseed, the prologue. And I'm happy to say she was able to make time to record it for you this afternoon here in my office at Tottering on the Brink. This reading is dedicated to her Zero-G companions last weekend, Kathleen McDonough and James Spostow, and also to Dr. Peter Diamandis and all the impeccable staff of his Zero-G Corporation.
Starseed. Prologue. I always danced. Like all babies, I was born kicking. I just never stopped. All during my childhood, it was that way. In the 1980s, Gambier Island had a permanent population of about 60, which no more than doubled in the summer. But it sure had a lot of theaters with proscenium stages. The garden, the living room, a certain clearing in the woods near Aunt Anya's place. I danced in them all, and most of all in my room with the door closed. Sometimes there was thunderous applause. Sometimes I danced for no one but myself. and sometimes for intimate friends who vanished at a knock on the door. I remember clearly the moment I first understood that dancing was what I was going to do with my life. Near sunset in late summer 1985, dinner and chores finished, my feet tickled. I told Dad where I was going and avoided Mom, slipped out through the shed without banging the door. It was a kilometer and a half to the government wharf. The afternoon had been warm and wet, wet enough, I thought, to keep most of our neighbors indoors and most boats at anchor. As I came over the last crest of the road and started down to the wharf, I saw I was right. I had the place to myself. I began to run down the hill, kicking off my shoes and tossing my jacket to the side of the road. At the far end of the wharf, I slowed and carefully descended the swaying gangway to the big dock float down at water level. I turned halfway down and scanned the shoreline one more time to be sure. No one in sight. I circled around the boathouse at the foot of the gangway. The boathouse cut off sight of the land. There was nothing but me and the sea and the islands in the distance. Gray-green mountains rising from the water. The water was highlit with sparkles of color from the sun setting behind me over the forest. A warm mist came and went invisibly. Well, even dry clothes are a nuisance when you dance. My clothes went under the rowboat that lay turtle-backed against the boathouse. The float's surface was rough enough for safe footing when wet, but soft enough for bare feet. I turned my back to the land and faced the sea. There are bigger theaters, but not on Earth. My parents were unreconstructed hippies, quasi-Buddhist. For their sake, I bowed to the sea, then waved to it for my own, the sober, dignified wave a serious artist gives her expectant public when she's 11 years old. A passing gull gave my cue. "Ladies and gentlemen, Rain McLeod." The music swelled. I've become too sophisticated to remember the steps I improvised. They must have been some mutant amalgamation of what I thought ballet was and all the other kinds of dance I'd felt in my body but had no names for then. Nomenclature doesn't matter to an 11-year-old. I danced, and what was in my heart came out my limbs and torso. I've wished since that I could still dance like that, but I've lost the necessary ignorance. I do remember that I was very, very happy. Complete. Well, someone in the back row coughed. Xalophus californianus, a sea lion, distinguished from harbor seals even at that distance by the distinct ears, passing Gambier on his way back home from a day of raiding. Fishermen hate the sea lions, call them pirates of the sea. They'll take one bite from each fish in your net and spoiling the whole catch, then leave with the best one, waving it at you mockingly as they go. I always secretly like them. They always danced, so it seemed to me. Drama and tragedy in the water, slapstick comedy when they were on land. He was perhaps 50 meters due east of the dock, treading water and staring at me. He coughed again, sounding very much like grandfather. I didn't let him interrupt me. I worked a friendly hello wave into what I was doing, and I kept on dancing. I noticed him out the corner of my eye from time to time, watching me in apparent puzzlement, but he was no more a distraction than a cloud or a gull would have been. Until there were two of him. Well, for a moment I treaded water myself, planting my feet so I faced them, and dancing only with torso and arms. They were identical, gray and wet, a few meters apart, their eyes and slick heads glistening with reflected sunset. The new one gave a cough of its own, softer and higher. Grandfather and Grandmother Mead. They watched me with no discernible expression at all, giving me their complete attention. Perfect bobbing Buddhas. So I danced for them. Well, at them. I made no attempt to translate what I was feeling into sea lion dance to mimic the body language I'd seen them use so they could understand better. Well, even at 11, I was arrogant enough to be more interested in teaching them my dance language, telling them who I was. When you're that young, expressing yourself is better than being understood. So I continued to dance inhuman, and for the whole cycloramic world of sea and sunset, but began subtly aiming it at the sea lions, as though they were the two important critics in a packed theater, or my actual grandparents come to see my solo debut. What luck to have spent my childhood so far away from Vancouver's ballet classes that no one had yet told me how I was supposed to move. I was still able to move the way I needed to invent anything my heart required. It felt good. That's all this highly trained 46-year-old can remember. For a time machine and video gear, you can have anything I own. The sea lions were 20 meters closer, and there were 4 of them now. They were treading water in ragged formation, close enough for me to see whiskers. By logical extension of my original whimsy, the new arrivals were the paternal grandparents I'd never met, the McLeods, ghosts in the audience. It gave an added layer of meaning to what I was doing, as much awareness of mortality and eternity as an 11-year-old is capable of. I danced on. The first breezes of evening found the sweat under my hair and on my chest and chilled them. I increased my energy output to compensate. I was grinning and spinning. 7 sea lions, 20 meters away, faces absolutely blank, staring. Everything came together. Sea, sky, purple clouds of sunset, sea lions, to generate that special magic always sought and so seldom found. I lost myself. The dance began dancing me. It burst out of me like laughter or tears, without thought or effort. My legs were strong, wind infinite. Ideas came. Every experiment worked and suggested the next. There's a special state of being, the backwards of a trance, where you transcend yourself and become a part of everything, where you seem to stand still, while the world dances around and through you. Many dancers never experience it. I'd been to that level a few times before, for fleeting moments. This time, I knew I could stay as long as I wanted. Time stopped. I danced on. Even an 11-year-old body has limits. Every dance has a natural, logical end. Eventually, with warm contentment and mild regret, I left Nirvana and returned to the world of illusion again. I was still, upright, arms upthrust toward the clouds, reaching for the unseen stars. The float was ringed by more than 12 sea lions, the farthest within 5 meters of me. I looked round at them all, half expecting them to clap and bark like cartoon seals. They stared at me, bobbing in silent syncopation, seeming to be thinking about what they'd just seen. My first applause. Well, I bowed deeply, and then waved grandly. Darkness was falling fast. Sweat dripped from me, my soles tingled, and many muscles announced their intention to wake up stiff tomorrow. I was perfectly happy. This, I thought, is what I'm supposed to do. My thing, as Mum was always calling it, what I would do with my life. I understood now what I had always sensed, that Mum was going to hate it, though I didn't yet understand why. But that didn't matter anymore. Maybe that's when you become an adult, when your parents' opinions no longer control. I kept silent when I returned home that night, but the next day I called Grandmother in Vancouver and told her that she had won the tug-of-war with my mother. I moved into her huge house on the mainland and let her enroll me in ballet class and in normal school like other kids. Within weeks I'd been teased so much over the name Rain McLeod, which had never struck anyone on Gambier Island as odd, well, that I changed it to Morgan. It seemed to me a much more dignified name for a ballerina. It was a long time before I saw Gambier Island again. I always danced, but from the day of the sea lions, dancing was just about all I did, all I was, for 32 years, until the day came when my body simply wouldn't do it anymore. The day in April 2017, when Dr. Thompson and Dr. Amiga told me that even more surgery would not help, that I could never dance again. My lower back and knees were spent. I tried the dancer's classic escape hatches for a few years, choreography, teaching. When they didn't work for me, I tried living without dance. I even tried relationships again. Nothing worked, including me. There were lots of trained, experienced professionals looking for work as technological progress made more and more occupational specialties obsolete. There were few job openings for a 46-year-old who could barely type. Even the traditional unskilled labor jobs were increasingly being done by robots. Sure, I could go back to school and, in only a few years of drudgery, acquire a new profession, ideally one that would not be obsolete by the time I graduated. But what for? Nothing interested me. The salt of the earth had lost its savor. I went back to Gambier Island. By now it was becoming a suburb of Vancouver. Even in winter there were stores and cars and paved roads and burglaries. There was talk of a condominium complex, too. I sat for 6 months in the cabin where I had been born, waiting for some kind of great answer to come from out of the sky. I visited my parents' graves frequently, sat zazen in the woods, split cords of wood, read the first 20 pages of a dozen books, walked the parts of the island that were still wild by day and night. Nature accepted my presence amiably, but offered no answers. Nothing. I went down to the wharf and consulted the sea lions, as I had many times. They had nothing to say. They just looked at me as if waiting for me to begin dancing. After enough days of that, nothing started to look good to me. I filled out the euthanasia application I'd brought with me, putting down earliest possible for date, leaving the space for reason blank. I'd have a response within a week or two, and by the end of the month, unless I changed my mind, my problems would be over. In my bones, I was a dancer, and I couldn't dance anymore. Not anywhere on earth. That very night, I was lying in the hammock behind the house watching the stars, when my eye was caught by a large, bright one. It moved relative to the other stars, so it was a satellite. It moved roughly north to south and was quite large. It had to be top step. Funny, I'd never thought of it before. The house the star dance built, as the media called it, transplanted asteroid, parting gift of alien gods, the place where they made angels out of people. Hollow stone cigar, phallic womb in high orbit. Gateway to immortality, to the stars, to freedom from every kind of human fear or need there was. And all it cost was everything you had, forever. Well, dancers say you go where the work is. Suddenly, at age 46, I had nowhere to go but up.
And that's how I learned to stop arguing with my wife's suggestions. Now, just in case you're listening to this podcast while driving, operating heavy machinery, or otherwise unable to access your browser, in a few minutes I'll read you some excerpts from the blog of last weekend's first zero-G flight from Las Vegas that was kept by Jeannie, Kathleen, Jim, and myself. But first, the holidays are ending, and I got to see my beloved take a step closer to her dream, and I got to see Cirque du Soleil perform to the Beatles' Love remix. I certainly have no complaints. But I do have some mild regrets. Not getting to spend any of the holidays with our daughter and her husband meeting his family in Niterói, Brazil, and not getting to spend any time with Jeannie's family in North Dartmouth, Massachusetts this year. Not to say that my own family are chimps. Nice people, all the ones out of jail, but scattered all up and down the East Coast. Jeannie's four sisters and mom and a ton of other relatives, both Italian and Portuguese, are within driving distance of each other, so the parties are always large, memorable, and well-executed. And more than that, listen to what kind of stuff happens when they're all sitting around the living room after the feast. The eldest sister sits down at the grand piano her late father bought the day she was born. The youngest sister and her husband sit side by side on the couch, she not quite close enough to the mic. And without discussion or rehearsal, stuff like this goes down.
Way up there?
Thank you.
To those of you who were not fortunate to live in or near the province of Nova Scotia during the prime of Jeannie's performing career and never got to see her dance, perhaps it will convey something if I say that she danced the way her older sister Kathleen just played the piano, her youngest sister Dory just sang, and Dory's husband Don just played the guitar on that level of excellence. And she choreographs on that level to this day. Speaking of which, here are some of those blog excerpts I promised you. The first one is one I wrote as they were in the air, titled The View from Down Here. Spider here, using Jeannie's laptop to blog. They just left the ground, Jeannie, Kathleen, and Jim, bubbling with excitement and happy as pigs in Parliament. I've got a couple of hours to kill now while I wait for them to come back down. As I type this, I can't stop thinking of Anousheh Ansari, who, to the best of my knowledge, was the first woman ever to blog from space, an achievement for which I once nominated her for the annual Heinlein Award for Fiction and Nonfiction Promoting Spaceflight. We all owe her a great deal. The Stardance team salutes her. The pre-flight briefing was most impressive, thorough, careful, thoughtful. The video they showed of people experiencing parabolas featured Dr. Peter Diamandis himself front and center, clearly and unmistakably having the time of his life. No question, he gets space. I think of him as the closest living equivalent to Robert Heinlein's immortal character, Delos D. Harriman, the man who sold the moon. Dr. Diamandis makes him look like a piker, really, because he's the man who sold space itself. By the way, has everyone heard by now the story about where he originally got the money for the famous $10 million XPRIZE? Talk about a Delos D. Harriman. When he first announced the XPRIZE, Dr. Diamandis was bluffing. Up there on stage with astronauts and politicians announcing the 10-megabuck prize, he didn't have 10 million cents. Nobody ever asked me, he told me with a grin when I met him this summer in Kansas City at Robert Heinlein's 100th birthday party. Fortunately, one day he was reading an article in Forbes about the Ansari family and their fabulous achievements, and it mentioned peripherally that one of the Ansaris, Anousheh, had always cherished a deep interest in space and space travel. Peter was on the phone over 5 minutes later, and the rest, as they say, is social studies. And seriously, I recommend you hunt down her blogs on the net. They're well worth reading, even if you spent your life imagining this stuff. She observes well, and she writes well. I'd also like to take this opportunity to say that the jumpsuit Zero-G Corporation uses was designed specifically to make my wife even more beautiful than nature did, a formidable accomplishment. Kathleen, too, looks stunning in the outfit. Jim doesn't look bad either, for that matter. Me, while nobody was looking, I snaffled a pair of gold Zero-G socks, so I have at least some of a spacesuit I can wear when I get home. I'm totally impressed by the whole Zero-G Corporation package, start to finish. These folks are really, really good at what they do. I have absolute confidence in Jeannie's safety, but more than that, everyone here rates at least 11 on a scale of 10 for friendliness and kindness. They're all the kind of people you instantly wish you knew socially, and they have more than gone out of their way to accommodate us and our special needs. Jeannie and Kathleen and Jim are sharing their section of the plane with 7 or 8 other people, but I have the feeling some good video will come out of it. Perhaps someone else in this blog has been correcting the impression being given by some newspaper copy editors, difficult for me to tell on this flaky Wi-Fi interface, but just in case the three have all been too busy, I'd like to make it clear that, contrary to what one or two newspapers have said, no IMAX footage is even being attempted here. For one thing, we don't have that kind of gear to play with yet. And, as I say, we're sharing a space with strangers this time, and our basic purposes are to familiarize Jeannie and Kathleen with Zero-G, check out at least some of the choreography Jeannie's been creating in her mind for the last 30 years and see how well it works in practice, to get some footage that will hopefully help us in fundraising and promotion efforts for the movie, and to have some fun. By my calculations, their plane, G-Force 1, should have just about reached their dedicated flying area by now, which means any minute they'll start their evolution. So I'm going to sign off now and try to join my wife telepathically as she and Kathleen slip the surly bonds. Oh, and one last thing to mention. Last night, when we got back to our hotel room, I put on the TV, and the very first image to appear was, incredibly, Jeannie's sister Kathy conducting and playing piano for Dionne Warwick. Talk about good omens. Join me now as I wander the spaceways with my beloved and her buddies. Thank all of you out there so much for the help, support, and encouragement that got us this far. All the way back to those of you who voted us the 1977 Best Novella Hugo for Stardance. The next blog to be posted from www.stardancemovie.com was from Jeannie, titled Back on Earth Again. This certifies, says the piece of paper, that Gene Robinson has defied gravity, communed with floating objects, levitated, and otherwise successfully completed the zero-G weightless experience. Damn right. We're back, safe and sound, but exhausted. Jim will be spending the next few hours looking over the video footage. It'll be a while before we have something to post. But in the meantime, he did show me the edited version of yesterday's tech rehearsal, and with any luck, he'll post some of that soon. As for me, I'm just getting over the disorientation they told us would typically happen. I may have it worse than my two companions, because I was also a bit more troubled by air sickness than they were, which might have been the byproduct of all the things I was trying to do at once in order to help Kathleen, combined with my own excitement. Things were a bit more chaotic than we'd expected. A lot of our plans went right out the window in the first few weightless arcs. But we'd anticipated that, and were able to just do what we could and adapt as well as possible to circumstances. Kathleen said the tendency to drift changed everything. You never knew whether you were liable to find yourself moving left, right, up, or down, or some combination thereof. In her next breath, she said she looks forward to working with this more now that she's had some experience of it and knows what to expect. It's a challenge, but one she found enjoyable. Dancers love physical challenges. The first few arcs, we just enjoyed ourselves, and I had the greatest of times imaginable. After that, I was just so busy I barely had time to register how I was feeling. We both agreed we wished each arc could be about three times as long. No wonder the Apollo 13 film crew had to go through 1,500 of those arcs just to get the few minutes of real zero-G seen in the movie. The Zero-G Corporation folks more than accommodated us. They went miles out of their way to help us and adapt to our special needs. To start, they surprisingly cut back the numbers in our section. In addition to the three of us, there were only four others in the gold section who were all most respectful of our needs. I'm more grateful to the staff than I can say, especially our personal coach, Chase, and JT, a newcomer to the staff, who held the light for us through each arc. They were all superb at what they do, from guest services manager Phil Clark, to the pilot, to the folks who gave us the standard airport TSA wand search before boarding. Upon return, we were all taken to a re-gravitation party, complete with a champagne toast. It gave us all a chance to share our experiences, and also to begin to come out of that disorientation I mentioned earlier. Each of us got to keep our zero-G flight suit, duffel bag, a T-shirt, and a framed 8x10 photo of our whole flight team, with the certificate attesting to our flight mentioned above, and a DVD, which includes both video and stills, will be sent to us later. In mid-flight, by the way, one young man topped all great memory moments by tossing his partner a diamond ring and asking her to marry him. Fortunately, she said yes, so gravity has probably not returned to him yet. She told me later she had been wondering why he was so uncharacteristically nervous before we lifted. It couldn't have been a more breathtaking and memorable experience. Everything I imagined and more, and as you know, I've been imagining this for decades. My deepest thanks go to Dr. Peter Diamandis, without whom I'd still be at home imagining it instead of remembering it. We found everything about Zero-G Corporation's operation to be impeccable. I hope some of you readers will get the chance to enjoy the experience yourselves. And now I'm going to rest. Oddly tiring. Floating. Next to post was Jim Spostow, who wrote, I'm happy to say that for my money we had a successful flight in zero-G. As I write this, I am capturing the footage from the day's shoot. You will all be able to see something soon, if only a single clip teaser of what's to come. As Gene mentioned, our plans went out the window with Mary Poppins when we discovered the conditions far less controllable than we had originally planned. Below is some footage from our pre-flight inspection of the airplane. Yes, we had an idea of what it would be like, and we knew what we wanted to accomplish, but nothing could prepare us for the real thing. And we had planned for that, too. Result, we have footage, good footage. We have experienced microgravity. The information we have gathered will be very important to our film, but most importantly, we have all had the time of our lives. More to come. Cheers, friends. After that, Jim posted a little teaser and said, as you can gather by some of the previous posts, we got good footage, but not in the exact way we'd planned. We haven't edited anything together, but we did promise a taste of the results. Here's Kathleen dancing in zero-G, accompanied by the music of our composer, James Raymond. You've been patient, thanks. Our apologies in advance for the reduced quality of the YouTube conversion. We hope to optimize in the next week. After that, I guess there's two more posts to go. After that, I posted, now that's a Happy New Year. On January 1st, I wrote, we are finally home from lost wages, more or less unpacked, back on our regular, reliable internet connection. The email and mail have been, we'll glance that. Nourishment has been taken, and I'm just about to crash several hours earlier than usual for me. But I do have the strength left to say that I am so proud of Jeannie, I could float off the floor myself. She and her two fabulous freefall friends accomplished something truly remarkable. She's tasted something she's been dreaming about since 1976. Awesome. Before she fell asleep tonight, I had the honor and warm pleasure of hanging her blue zero-G jumpsuit in our closet. One day, perhaps it'll be her pressure suit. Wouldn't surprise me. That Prince Humperdinck, he must be some kind of fella to have a bride like that. Good night slash morning to all you family, friends, and strangers from around the planet who joined Jim, Kathleen, and Jeannie on their journey, whether through this blog or just through the noosphere. Your presence and warm support were palpable and deeply appreciated. The stars are here. I'll read you just one more excerpt now, one of the most recent and one of the most interesting from Kathleen McDonough, Stardancer herself. It's titled, The Right Stuff Spelled parentheses W and parentheses R-I-T-E. What is it to prepare for dancing in zero gravity? The beginning, like all performances, requires a strong immersion in the imaginative world, except this time I am very aware of the lack of one critical element I have been able to count on from day one of my existence, the pull of our gravitational force. At times I've made friends with it. Other times, apologized over its consistency and dreamt of its abolishment on occasion. But I am a realist, and it is something I attend to regularly, perhaps in a more heightened sense than most Homo sapiens. It is my business, after all. Peripheral to this large part of the equation are all the other constraints that will exist within the freedom of zero-G. Spatial limitations, dynamic restrictions, no fast movements, or at least tempered due to their implications. What of the interpretation of Jeannie's choreography and translating that amidst a romper room of other flyers present that are there with the singular and most worthy of pursuits, play? There are timing issues, how long a duration for each arc, and also the discovery of the drift. Drifting. I am a sizable woman with a 7.5-foot stretch from fingertip to toe tip. Expansion. Will I be able to expand? Preceding hopping off to Las Vegas, I have read and listened to Jeannie. We've had much dialogue, and I feel an empathy with her aesthetic. I have a strong affinity with her ideas, her interests, and I fall in love with her passion. It is easy to get on board with her, and I have total admiration for her commitment and desire to fulfill her vision. I am also honored that she has asked me to go on this journey with her long before the zero-G flight was even a possibility. From a purely physical, technical point of view, there are two practices in my life that dominate and serve this work. The gyrotonic method and contact improvisation. These have followed a lifetime of dance that has seen me engage in numerous practices that have informed my body of work. Gyrotonic has a spherical, three-dimensional intention, works with arcs and spirals, undulations, while contact provides a responsivity in the body by constantly addressing a mind-body connectivity and attention to gravity, a hyper-inner ear attunement if ever there was one. I have always felt gyrotonic and contact to be complementary, but never knew how much they would serve the zero-G space. At the center of all the elements in the soup and all the preparation with my imagination preceding the flight was the recognition that foremost is presence. We spoke of and worked on choreographed movement, but there was always the very real, but who knows? And indeed, ambition takes a side seat to presence. Not to say the effort to fulfill objectives wasn't present. It was. But assessment in the air came quickly as individuals and collectively, and so we pursued the highest objective of space travel. Exploration. Wow, did I write that? Yes, it was short, but somehow epic, and I feel blessed. I hovered into a new year, and though I feel firmly rooted back on Earth, I am truly grateful for this most unique experience of levity, a real physical imprint of what I have only before imagined. Big thanks to Jeannie and Spider, James Spostow, and Zero G, and all those who have been moved to participate in supporting this vision. In my dreams, I'll revisit this land and look forward to more with the Stardance team. And yes, Spider, from the moment we walked onto the tarmac with Maverick helicopters nosing into liftoff and circling in for a landing, I felt my dad. Rotors are like a lullaby to me. I call these my Mike flybys. Nothing like slipping the surly bonds. Signed, Kathleen McDonough, parentheses, Cosmonaut Kate. There's lots more good stuff to be had at http://stardancemovie.blogspot.com. Just sign up, keep scrolling down the page, you'll find some stills. You'll even, if you keep scrolling long enough, come upon the two video snippets mentioned earlier. That's about all we give away for free here, folks. And a good time is guaranteed for all. I'm going to leave you now with one last taste of Jeannie's sister Kathy, her sister Dory, and Dory's husband Don. If you'd like to see, by the way, Kathy working with Dionne Warwick, as mentioned earlier, there's a new Live in Concert DVD that features her centrally throughout. Next week, I hope to get around to those science fiction book reviews I've been promising you for a couple of weeks now. Here now, instead, are Kathleen Rubico and Dory and Don Leger a couple of Thanksgivings ago, making it up as they go along. on this final track, Kathy lays out in favor of Don. But Judy's other two sisters, Laurie O'Neill and Mary Rodericks, jump in, this being a James Taylor-loving family, joined in at the end by Judy's mom, Dorothy Rubico. Here now, pretty much the whole damn Rubico family, doing Carole King's immortal, You've Got a Friend. Thanks again for coming to my Zero-G party here at Spider on the Web. Your comments are welcomed at spiderweb@shaw.ca, and your donations would be much appreciated at www.spiderrobinson.com/podcast.html. See you next week.